We are now in our second worldview. This is polytheism, and that's what we're going to talk about for a little while. And we'll just go until I've said all I need to say on polytheism, and then we'll stop. So
okay.
It may be 1 hour, it may be 1 hour and 10 minutes. Just, you know. Okay. So it's probably not going to take us the full 2 hours to get through what I want to get through today. Polytheism is an interesting worldview because it's the one worldview where the ultimate reality can be empirically verified. And yet no one has empirically really verified this ultimate reality. I mean, some people do claim to have experiences with the gods or to have seen them. But it's been a long time since anyone has seen Thor flying around or Zeus.
Well, I was gonna say, in the common tongue, how would you empirically verify it?
Well, I mean, if they're living on Mount Olympus, in theory, you would just be able to go there and see them
Okay. Hanging
out, you know. And unfortunately, they're not there. Maybe they're on Mars's version of the Mount. You know, there's a Mount Olympus on Mars, so
maybe they moved there.
But
isn't Mars supposed to be a god himself?
Well, Mars is obviously named after a god, but who knows? Maybe the gods. Maybe they're perplexed at the fact that we named their planet after one of their gods. Zeus is probably saying, "Why? Why would you do that?" Obviously, the prefix poly, polis, means many, and theos means God, so you have many gods. And polytheism is an overarching term that sort of umbrellas a bunch of different perspectives. And so we're going to look at each perspective, beginning with animism, and you'll notice that we'll start very basic, and it starts sort of as, you know, there's spirits in the trees and so forth, and then we have a god ruling over those trees and over the water, another one over the waters, and another one over the land and so forth. And then we have one god who rules them all. And then we have we narrow it down to two gods warring with each other, and then we have just one god warring against chaos. So there's a kind of broad movement from the many to the one in this presentation of polytheism.
Even within polytheism, it eventually ends up at one.
Yeah, there's some versions of polytheism that kind of have one major god to worship and so forth. So animism is the first of these views. Animus means spirit or soul. And the idea is that there are forces of nature out there, and they're animated by the spirits. So why do the trees sway in the wind? Or why does the wind blow? Because there's a spirit behind it, moving it. There's a force of nature. All the forces of nature are accounted for by personal spirits. This idea can be interpreted in several senses. One sense is that the animists generally believe that there is a spiritual energy that is diffused into and throughout all things. Another version of animism would say that each particular thing in nature has a life force or spirit. So it really just depends on the animist you're talking about. It is estimated that nearly 40% of the world's population is animistic.
40?
Yeah. This is partially accounted for because the viewpoint taps into an intuition that humans have held since the dawn of human history, namely that there is an explanation for everything. A person living in, say, 3000 BC or BCE notices the tree swaying in the breeze. What makes the wind move? What animates the life-giving fruit growing from this tree or plant? The animistic answer is that just as there is a soul animating the body of a human being, so also there's a spirit giving life and movement to the wind, the tree, the plant, the grass, and so forth. Without the spirit forces residing in nature, there is no way to explain why a physical object has life, moves, and sustains itself. Without the midichlorians, we would have no knowledge of the force.
I was going to say, there's got to be a Star Wars reference.
But see, what Lucas is doing is he's fusing pantheism and polytheism. The midichlorians give us the knowledge of the Force, and the midichlorians themselves are a part of the Force. Another interesting feature of animism is that it's not bound to a particular religion. There are animistic Christians. So when you, this was especially true in the Middle Ages, you would have like local witch doctors and astrologers and people like that in the local village, but you would also have a priest. And so people felt no contradiction at all in going to the priest to confess their sins, but also in going to an animistic person to get, say, a healing medicine or something like that, because animists were always, because we believe that there are forces in nature that are active. The idea is that, you know, there were Indian myths, for example, that said that for every poison out there, there's a cure. So the demons out there are putting poisons in plants, and the good gods out there are putting, you know, the cures for those poisons in other plants. And so that's a common thing among animistic cultures as well. So Christians in the Middle Ages would often go to these animistic type people and get cures from them or get advice on how to deal with some problem. There are also animistic Hindus and Muslims. Obviously, the indigenous religions of Africa and the Americas are animistic. The animism of these peoples is often called folk religion, for it is a remnant of the religious ideas held by various tribes and cultures before they converted to either Christianity or Islam. Such persons would grant that the monotheism of Islam, for example, answers the questions of ultimate significance. However, since Allah is fairly abstract and removed from the daily life of the people, one must turn to the spirits and nature for day-to-day guidance. A good example of how this move from the ultimate to the proximate is made can be found in the so-called New Age movement. In the early days of the movement, which we can place around the mid-1960s, there was an emphasis on meditation and unity with the one or the all. New Agers were almost exclusively pantheistic in their outlook. But starting around the early 1990s, the emphasis has been channeling spirits and finding one's own spirit guide. Wicca, which is becoming quite popular today, is a form of witchcraft that attempts to manipulate the forces of nature for one's own purposes. Wiccan can be seen as a halfway perspective between animism and full-blown polytheism. Full-blown polytheism, that is. So there, that's animism in a nutshell. Any thoughts or questions? Or
no, it's pretty straightforward.
In Hinduism, I don't know if you knew this, but Hinduism was originally a polytheistic religion. It evolved into pantheistic. Okay. So,
so let's revisit those again, the differences. Polytheism, be many gods.
Yes.
Belief in many divine beings. Pantheism is belief that everything is God.
Yes. Okay. So the belief that everything is God, or there's one necessary force that controls all, that does not really develop fully in Hinduism until we hit the 6th century BC. And as I've always told my students, the most important century in human history is the 6th century BC. Without a doubt, that is the...
Why do you say that?
That is the birth of philosophy. Thales predicted an eclipse, and philosophy is born. That's 586 BC. That same year, the Jerusalem temple was destroyed. The Jewish people go into exile. And that is where they collect the books that we now call the Old Testament. So the Hebrew Bible was collected and given its final edition sometime in the 6th to 5th century BC. Buddha is around during this time. Confucius is around during this time. We could go on and on. Coinage is developed during this time. The Babylonian Empire is going strong for most of that century, and then the Persians take over, and that sets things up for the Greeks. Persians were the ones that developed the punishment of crucifixion, which is...
So it wasn't the Romans.
It wasn't the Romans. They perfected it, but it was the Persians that developed it. You can go on and on of all the things that happened that century. The second most important century, I would say, is the 16th century AD. You have the birth of a whole bunch of other religions, the Reformation, and all of that. And then a third one would be the first century AD. Now, some people think I'm blaspheming Jesus or something because he lived during that century. But, yeah, I mean, we have him doing the things that he's doing, and that's incredibly important, especially if you're a Christian. But in terms of just the breadth of different movements that are going on, the 6th century B.C. and the 16th century A.D. are just incredible. So the Hindus started off polytheistic. If animism places the spirits of natural forces within the events and facts of nature, polytheism distinguishes the forces of nature from the gods or goddesses who rule over them. Hinduism may very well be the quintessential form of polytheism, for it would appear that Hinduism was polytheistic before it developed into a form of pantheism. The Vedas were written hundreds of years before the Upanishads. And these are holy texts of the Hindus. The Vedas were developed in the 16th century BC, and the Upanishads were developed in the 6th century BC. All right? So the Upanishadic revolution happens in the 6th century. And so all that time beforehand, your average Hindu, quote-unquote, was worshiping just their individual god. And if you go to India today, they are a nation of just many, many gods. The intellectuals are pantheistic, but the common person on the street is polytheistic. The Rig Veda in particular gives us quite a few deities, many of which have lost their importance over time. Deus Pitar was the original sky god who fell out of significance even before the Rig Veda was written down.
You fall out of significance.
Because your title is replaced by someone else. I mean, the Christian god has fallen out of significance today by many people. We're no longer a Christian culture. Some people see all of the things that are going on with the religious right and all of that as just sort of the death blows of Christianity. It's their last gasp to retain power. And the thought is that eventually we will move on as a species and look back at Christianity, kind of like we look back at polytheism and say, wow, that was strange. You know. Varuna seems to have replaced him, that is Deus Pitar, although he too fell out of significance. Indra was the supreme god, king of the gods, at least during the Vedic period. According to the Upanishads, Indra is supreme because he recognized the superiority of Brahman, the force that made all the gods. It should be noted that many of the Hindu gods changed their function over time. So Vishnu, the sun god, later takes on the characteristic of being the preserver of all that exists. Rudra, the mountain god, changes his name to Shiva, the destroyer. Brahma seems to be one of the most important deities in the pantheon, for he is the creator god. But all the gods in the Hindu pantheon, at least when we get to the 6th century BC, are swallowed up into Brahman. This universe, before it was created, existed as Brahman, says the Upanishads. Brahman created out of himself priests, warriors, tradesmen, and servants among both gods and men, and all the gods, while they live, and after they have ceased to live, exist in Brahman. So the gods are mortal. Since Brahman is supreme over Brahma, no less joy than Brahma has the seer to whom the self has been revealed and who is without craving. In other words, the person who knows Brahman has just as much bliss as Brahma the creator. You're more familiar with the Greco-Roman polytheism. That is the Greek pantheon. Zeus for the Greeks, Jupiter for the Romans, right? Apollo, Hermes, those guys. Homer gives the story of Zeus complaining to his nagging wife. He says, Hera, you must not expect to be informed of all my counsels. You are my wife, but you would find it hard to understand them. When it is proper for you to hear, there is no one, god or man, who will be told sooner. when I mean to keep a matter to myself, you must not pry, nor should you ask questions, Hera. A few lines later, after the gods have had their feast, Zeus, the Olympian lord of thunder, hid himself to the bed in which he always slept, and when he had got on to it, he went to sleep with Hera of the golden throne by his side. The Roman pantheon, of course, is similar. Zeus becomes Jupiter, Apollo becomes Mars, Poseidon, god of the sea, becomes Neptune, Aphrodite, goddess of love, becomes Venus, Hermes becomes Mercury, Hades becomes Pluto, Cronus, god of agriculture, becomes Saturn. So the planets that we have are all named after the Roman version of the Greek gods. Uranus or Uranus means heaven. While there were innovations in the writings of Hesiod, for example, Zeus is more sovereign in Hesiod than in Homer, there continues to remain in Hesiod the notion that the gods are creatures. Tell how the first gods and the earth came to be. Verily at first chaos came to be, but next earth and Eros, fairest among the deathless gods. Okay, so what do you notice about the gods that I've been reading about here? What's the most important thing to note about them?
They're constantly changing.
They're constantly changing. They're constantly changing their position. You're out of favor now. We're going to worship you. That's especially true in the Hindu tradition.
And their deity is dependent upon the people, in other words.
Well, their significance is dependent upon the people.
Yeah, when people decide they're no longer important as a deity, they move on to somebody else.
That's right. And then what else? What else do you notice about these gods?
I may be the same as the first statement. So they change depending on the culture. I'm not sure.
They're also creatures. They had a beginning. They, all of these gods, Brahman created the gods in the east, and chaos gave us the gods in the west. So they're all products of this universe in some manner or fashion. That's a very important point to note. We move on to henotheism. Now, there is a view called the evolutionary view of religion, and the evolutionary view goes something like this. Human beings were first animistic, and then over time they evolved into polytheism, and then henotheism, and then monotheism. And henotheism, heno means one, so it means one god or one godism, but henotheism is different from monotheism because in monotheism, the existence of other gods is not recognized. There's only one god, but in henotheism, many gods are recognized, but you're asked to worship only one. And you can. There's even a tendency in the Greek culture to emphasize one god, so that Athens, the city of Athens, is dedicated to Athena. So that's the god we worship. So in a sense, that even really rank polytheism expresses itself henotheistically. Yeah, we recognize Zeus and Apollo and all that, but we've dedicated ourselves to Athena. There is one religion in particular that says there's only one God worthy of worship, even though there are many gods, and it's a modern religion. Can you guess what it is if you haven't read ahead?
No, I kind of cheated and read ahead. Yeah. It's Mormonism.
Yeah, Mormonism is the quintessential version of henotheism in so many respects. First of all, because some of the versions of henotheism in the past, as I just pointed out, are really just polytheism. I don't think that the Athenians would ever say that Athena is the only one worthy of worship. It's just the only one we choose to worship. But Mormons will say Elohim is the only one truly worthy of worship for us. And so what the Mormons do is they believe that the universe is eternal. Do you know much about Mormonism?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is fun. I'm going to tell you the story of
I've heard the history of it before, but
yeah,
I don't really know what their pillars.
The story of Mormonism is very interesting, but I'll start with the beginning. The universe for the Mormon is eternal. So if I were to take a time machine and go back billions upon billions of years, I'd still have another moment ahead of me. In other words, I can't go back and find a beginning of the universe. So the universe is eternal. It's not billions of years old. It's trillions upon trillions upon trillions of years old. And many billions of years ago, a little baby was born, and that baby grew up to be a righteous man and lived such a good life that when he died, he evolved immediately into godhood. And that baby's name was Elohim. In fact, Joseph Smith says in this in a sermon, and I'm quoting it at the bottom of the page, "First, God himself who sits enthroned in yonder heavens is a man like unto one of yourselves. That is the great secret. I'm going to tell you how God came to be God. We have imagined that God was God from all eternity. God himself, the Father of us all, dwelt on earth the same as Jesus Christ himself did. You have got to learn to be God yourselves." So Elohim evolved into deity, and not only did he do that, while he was living on earth, he acquired many wives. And when they died, they became goddesses. And Elohim and all of his goddesses journeyed throughout the cosmos and found a lifeless planet. And they began to multiply and give birth to other divine beings on other planets. And those divine beings themselves evolved into deity and so on and so forth. And so after many billions of years, Elohim had many sons and daughters from his many wives. Now, two of those sons from two different wives, their half-brothers, were named Jesus and Lucifer. So Lucifer is the half-brother of Jesus. Okay? And Elohim, by the way, I'm not kidding you, this is what they teach. And Elohim decides to go create life on another planet that he has sectioned out. It's called Earth. And in the divine chamber, as the God Elohim and his sons are sitting around talking about how they're going to make this world, Lucifer says, "Why don't we do something a little different? Why don't we make man in such a way that he must obey us? And therefore, we know there will be no sin and evil and all of that stuff, and we will actually have a servant who always serves us the way we want to be served. And so there will be no evil." And Jesus says, "No, no, no. We must give them free will, just like we had free will." And so Lucifer and Jesus start getting in a verbal argument, and next thing you know, things come to blows, and a war breaks out in heaven. Jesus ends up being victorious in this cosmic war. And so Elohim stands up to give his judgment. And he looks at, I'm not kidding you, he looks at all of the demons, all the followers of Lucifer, and he says, "You shall be demons who haunt planet Earth." And he casts Lucifer, who he now calls Satan, and all the demons, he casts them down to Earth. And then he looks at all the people, all the gods that follow Jesus, and he says, "You guys will end up being the white people that are born into Earth." And then they will be the white people. And then he looked at a bunch of other of his sons who remain neutral in this cosmic war. He says, "You guys will have to be reborn into the earth, and you will be the black people." So why are you black? Because you in a cosmic past were neutral in the most important cosmic war ever fought. And so you were cursed with black skin. Okay? This is a true story. And in fact, in the Book of Mormon, it says the more holy you become, the whiter your skin becomes. And the more godless you become, the darker your skin becomes. Okay. Now, we have, they basically just take on the biblical story after that. You have Adam and Eve, and then Lucifer comes and he tempts them. And then we have the flood afterwards. We have Moses, and we have the children of Israel, and so on and so forth, right? Around 600 BC, Babylon is the great power of the day, and Babylon is getting ready to totally destroy Jerusalem and Israel, and they do destroy Jerusalem in 586 BC. So around 590, 600, in that time frame, a group of Jews decide to get out of Dodge. They say, we got to go. We got to leave. And so they get on a boat and they sail down. They journey to where the Persian Gulf is, and they get on a boat and they sail all the way across the Pacific, and they land in Central America, which is wholly unpopulated at this time. And they populate the entire Western Hemisphere. And they become the... They become the Native Americans. They become the, in other words, all Native Americans are just Jews.
Okay, can't that be disproved by genealogy, DNA?
Well, we're about to get into that. But my point is that all of every single Native American you meet, according to the Book of Mormon, is Jewish. They are descendants of the people of Israel. Now, you have to understand, in the 1830s, when Joseph Smith was saying these things, that was one of the great mysteries. People genuinely did not know how the Native Americans got here. It was perplexing to them. You can explain why how an African can get to China, because all that land over there is connected, or seeable, or a travelable, if that's a word, via water. So you can cross a fairly small amount of water to get to that land and make your way there. So it wasn't that perplexing to note how people got from here to there in the old world. But how did people make it to the new world before Columbus? How did they get there? And people were genuinely debating this topic in the 1830s. And so what Joseph Smith was saying was plausible to a lot of people because it just wasn't known. Now, the Lehites and the Nephites, these are two tribes that develop in this time period. And around the year 400 AD, a great war breaks out, a big battle that takes place in what is now Upper State New York. And there's a big hill on which this battle is. There's a big mound, and under this mound is supposed to be all of the weapons that were buried there after this war. I'll talk about that in a minute. In any case, all of the white tribe, and I always forget if it's the Lehites or the Nephites, but they died. They were wiped out in this battle. The last of the Nephites, if I got the tribe right, is Mormon. His name was Mormon, and he has a son named Moroni. And they had golden tablets that told of their story since 600, from 600 BC until this great battle. They have the story written down on these golden tablets, and they buried these tablets under the ground before they died. Okay? Jump. You know, 1,000 years later, more than that, 1,400 years later, to the year 1830, Joseph Smith is walking through the woods, and Moroni appears to him, and he says, he leads Joseph Smith to these golden tablets. And Joseph Smith finds the golden tablets buried in this mound, and he can't believe it, and so he goes and he tells several people, especially one guy in particular by the name of Harris, and he says, I found these golden tablets. Now, Harris never saw the golden tablets. He tells Harris, I found these golden tablets, and we need to translate them because they were written in Reformed Egyptian, and I don't know how to translate them, but I have a seer stone that will help me translate the Reformed Egyptian into English. And Harris says, great. So the way this happened is a curtain separated Joseph Smith from Harris, and Joseph Smith looked into a hat where the golden tablets were, and he used the seeing stone that would miraculously help him translate. You're looking incredulous right now.
Let's keep going.
The seer stone would help him translate the Book of Mormon from Reformed Egyptian into English, and Harris wrote all this down. And I'm not sure if I even got the guy's name right, Harris, but the point is this guy wrote it down.
What's the point of the curtain?
If you're a Mormon, the whole point is that we need to live by faith and not by sight.
Well, Joseph Smith was using sight, was he not?
Yeah, but he's the prophet. But we follow the prophet, so he can do it. Now, once the Book of Mormon was written down, the Book of Mormon just is those golden plates. It's a copy of those golden plates. There was no need to keep the golden plates, you know, so there's no need to, like, put them in a museum or something like that so you can see them. And so the angel Moroni took them, along with the seer stone, back to heaven. And then Joseph Smith spent the rest of his days preaching this gospel of basically a new foundation for the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints. We're the Latter-day Saints because we're the ones that have the full canon. There's a canon, the Bible, written for the old world, and then there's a new canon, a Bible written for the new world, the Book of Mormon. Now, one thing I didn't tell you is that Jesus himself, when he rose from the dead, he said, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. When he ascended into heaven, he took a detour to the new world and actually came and visited the Native Americans. And so there are stories in the Book of Mormon of Jesus actually visiting the Native Americans and talking to them. And then he, of course, ascends up and goes to heaven. Of course, 300, 400 years later, we have this great battle where the godly white people die. And so it's a shame. But we have now the Book of Mormon. We have the full canon of Scripture that the church never really had until the Church of Jesus Christ, the Latter-day Saints, came along and found it. And so you should believe the Book of Mormon just as strongly as you believe the Bible. Everybody should believe the Bible, but everybody should believe the Book of Mormon too. And that's the history of Mormonism in a nutshell. Thoughts?
Not at the moment.
No thoughts?
The very first question that comes to mind, which is probably somewhat unanswerable, but I'd like to know where this baby generated from that created this lineage of cosmic gods.
Well, it's just part of the processes of nature. It's the process of the universe that just generates gods.
So the universe, while being eternal, also has the ability to create on its own.
Sure. Here's a principle for you. Given infinite time, anything that can happen will happen. Do you agree with that?
I suppose.
All right. Well, since the universe is eternal, it's perfectly possible for life to spontaneously generate somehow, somewhere, some way, on a planet somewhere. Given eternity, anything that can happen will happen. So all you got to do is have the right chemicals that just sort of come together. Now, because this whole process has been going on from all eternity, you also have to remember that the gods have been generated from all eternity, and they also helped guide the process. And, of course, no Mormon, at least the traditional Mormon, is not going to be a Darwinist or anything like that. So he'll have the forces of nature being guided by the many gods that do exist. And so there's no starting point to this process. One of the reasons why people get hung up on this is because they keep wanting to say, well, if there's a starting point, how did it all start? And you're like, well, there is no starting point. So it didn't just start. It's always been going on.
If they accept the Bible as being truth along with all this extra stuff, how do they reconcile a topic that we brought up before, and that is Jesus and the deity of Jesus, in other words?
Well, Jesus is a God.
A God.
Yeah, Elohim's a God, and Holy Spirit is a God, and, Lucifer is a God, and got all kinds of gods. Didn't Jesus say in John 10, he quoted the scriptures and he said, "You shall be gods." He's quoting Psalm 82.
I'd like to pull that up and look at it before I agree with you. I guess we're cheating a little bit because we're also doing this in your Sunday school, but what about the 10 references?
Yeah, those would all prove that Jesus is a God.
He's the God, not a God.
Well, he is the God for us, but that doesn't mean that he's the only God.
So you're saying like the Greek?
Paul says for us there's only one God. That's henotheism. He says, though there be many lords and many gods, for us, that's 1 Corinthians 8:6. So, yeah, the Mormonism, man, that's the way to go.
Okay. Well, I'm not convinced yet.
I haven't converted you to Mormonism?
No, I haven't been converted yet. I find it utterly convenient that...
By the way, let me say this. Since this is being recorded and other people can hear, I do apologize if I got some of these names wrong and mixed up. It's been a while since I've read these sources, but... And I'll be honest with you, I've not read through the entire Book of Mormon. It's not something, I mean, as you can, I'm saying this whole story tongue-in-cheek. It's kind of like Scientology to me. It's just not plausible. It's really suspicious when the very thing that you said you got the Book of Mormon from got whisked away to heaven.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Their source of knowledge no longer exists, in other words. They have a copy of it, but still the very source that they claim to be their knowledge no longer exists. But we say that the source of our knowledge is the Bible. Well, it's still here. Yes, we have different translations of it, but that is the source.
Now, I will say that they would liken the loss of the golden tablets with the loss of the original autographs of the Bible. But at least when it comes to the Bible, the original autographs were written on paper and were subject to wind and erosion, time, decay, that sort of thing. So that no one was claiming that the original Bible was written on some golden tablets and then got whisked away to heaven as a matter of convenience. They said the original Bible was written on parchments, that the text was copied onto other parchments as it decayed, but the text itself is therefore been preserved through transcription. But no one's ever made a claim of a golden tablet for the Bible that's likened unto the golden tablet that from which the Book of Mormon has come. And I would say this: it would be very disturbing if I couldn't take the church seriously if they said, "Oh yeah, a long time ago, Jesus was walking around with some golden tablets." And those golden tablets ascended up to heaven with them after the New Testament got copied. I would be like, well, you got to be freaking kidding me.
What about the tablets of the Ten Commandments? What if somebody brought up that argument that the Ten Commandments were written on tablets that disappeared and we have?
Well, according to the story, and if you don't believe the story, that's fine. But according to the story, the tablets were broken because Moses threw them and destroyed them. But then he did make new tablets and he put them in the ark. And so that for hundreds and hundreds of years, in principle, a person could go into the temple, and for a while it was the tabernacle, and open up the ark and find the tablets in there. So they weren't being hidden. Okay. They were being hidden in a sense. The priests were the ones that had access to that. But there was no claim, even when it came to the Ark of the Covenant, there was no claim that God came down and just took the ark back to heaven or something. Most people believe it was lost during the Babylonian captivity. It may have even been destroyed in the Babylonian captivity.
My question too about the golden tablets is, why would it be so important for them to have been kept and hidden in a hill or buried in the ground for such a long period of time to then be immediately found and then immediately transcribed and then immediately whisked back up to heaven? It's not a valuable fact. It just seems a little strange that it's going to be buried for this amount of time and then once they're done with it.
Yeah, why didn't Moroni take it up to heaven immediately after and then just bring it back down to Joseph Smith at the right time or something like that?
Well, it never originated from heaven either. These golden tablets came, and supposedly a reformed Egyptian, we would assume they came from Egypt then. And so they never originated from heaven?
Well, let me...
So what's the point of taking them back?
Let me quote a linguist who, in an interview, said, how much reformed Egyptian do you know? And the linguist looked at him and said, this is a guy from Cambridge. He goes, what is reformed Egyptian? he had never heard of the language.
Does it exist?
To my knowledge, no. To my knowledge, there is no such thing as reformed Egyptian.
So the argument might be, well, it was an ancient language that no longer
exists. Yeah, that their only hope there is to say, well, it was an ancient language that no one knows anymore. Here's a second fact that is disturbing. Not a single reference in the Book of Mormon has been vindicated by archaeology. No city, no anything. In fact, here's a fact that most students of history get disturbed when they read about the Spanish conquistadors coming into South America. And the reason they were able to totally overwhelm the Taino and then later the Aztecs is because the most sturdy weaponry that these peoples had were spears with the tips made out of obsidian, which is a volcanic rock. And that was the best they could do. Well, the Spaniards had iron. Well, the Book of Mormon speaks of the iron weapons of the Nephites and the Lehites and all these people. That means that iron, the Native Americans went through their own iron age. We have absolutely no evidence for that. And had they gone through their own iron age, the Indians would have been able to put up a whole lot better fight against the Spaniards. They may have been able to even repel them from the shores of the Americas if they had had those weapons. Now, of course, they didn't have horses either, and the Book of Mormon is replete with them riding on horses and things like that. Now, when it became clear that by 3,000 or 2000 BC at the latest, the horses had died out because the original Native Americans hunted them and killed them and ate them. Some Mormon apologists have argued, well, maybe these people rode around on deer. And then in the translation, they were called horses. Well, I find that to be an extremely implausible explanation for the false translation. The fact of the matter is, the Book of Mormon reads exactly like King James English. And it's very clear that Joseph Smith, clever fellow that he is, took King James language and just sort of twisted it in a way to make it sound like this is a new story happening in the New World. Now, some people believe that the Bible does the same thing with other myths. Fine. But at the very least, we, you know, just like the Bible talks about a Jerusalem, we can actually go to Jerusalem. No, it talks about a Damascus, we can go to Damascus. In other words, there are many biblical references that are vindicated by archaeology. That doesn't mean that every archaeological find is vindicated a biblical reference, but it does at least indicate that there's broad historical context where you find archaeological vindication for. You find none of that in the Book of Mormon. None. The other problem is the DNA evidence. We now know that no Jew landed on the shores of the Americas before, you know, 1492. We know that. And we've done DNA samplings of all the Native American tribes that are still around. There's no Jewish DNA to be had or found in any of them. This is a big problem, and the Book of Mormon Farms is their apologetics organization, and they're having a really hard time with this. And we're seeing more and more Mormons, when they get hold of this information, getting disturbed, getting upset, and leaving the faith. Yeah. By the way,
historical and archaeological evidence is difficult to argue with.
Right. For example, if you at least had a sliver of Jewish DNA in some Native American tribes. And see, they've even gone to tombs and found skulls and bones and studied them, and they've extracted DNA samples from them. So that, I mean, we've done a pretty thorough job here. If there was at least a sliver, you could argue what the new Mormons are arguing. They're saying, well, it's not like they populated the whole New World. These Jews that came over in 600 BC populated. They just created a society there. And what they're having to say now is that the society they created was just too small to guarantee a sampling. But that doesn't work.
The
original Book of
for all the rest of the Native Americans.
Well, they're having the new Mormons are having to say that not all Native Americans are descended from Jews, even though the Book of Mormon does read that way.
Then where'd they come from?
Well, they would follow the standard line that they crossed from Asia to the Bering Strait and all that stuff, but the Book of Mormon really does sound like all Native Americans are descended from these Jews.
I'd like to know how the Native Americans feel about that.
Yeah, you can look at a Native American and tell where they came from. They're Asian. They are clearly Asian. They are not. They're not Jewish. This is a problem.
I have an aside. In speaking about archaeological finds, I've been hearing since I was probably a teenager that Noah's Ark was found in Turkey. Do you know if there's any truth to that whatsoever? I know that's way off subject, but
there is no truth to that statement. My prediction is that Noah's Ark will never be found. By the way, according to the Book of Mormon, paradise was actually here in America, not in the Middle East. And the Garden of Eden was in Missouri. And what happened was when the flood came, the Ark was lifted up, of course, and carried over to the Middle East. Because it was a global flood, right? So the Ark could end up anywhere. So it was carried over there, and that's why the Middle East was populated the way it was. So there you go.
All right.
Anything else?
No, I don't think so.
I do say this on page 54. Mormonism is today a moving target, and I think Mormonism is just having a really tough time with these kinds of evidences. Bill Maher said it like this. He said, look, the resurrection of Jesus supposedly happened in the first century. And so you could at least make the case, well, it happened so long ago. And obviously you can't expect TV cameras to vindicate it or anything like that. But, you know, if we invent time travel and you were to go back in time and put your camera on the tomb that Jesus was buried in, assuming he was buried in the tomb, like the Bible says, and you were to put your camera on there, and nothing happens for 3 days. And maybe you might say, okay, well, maybe 3 days is a symbol for something. Let's hold out for a few more weeks. After a few weeks or months, if Jesus doesn't exit the tomb, then it's a sham. Christianity is a stupid fairy tale that no one should believe, right? I mean, it's just obvious. But we don't have that sort of thing right now, so at least traditional Christians can say, well, maybe, you know, it could have happened. Well, if you have this DNA evidence, we have actual hardcore evidence proving that the core story, not just some side detail, but the core story of the Book of Mormon, the whole premise upon which it's based, is false. Then you have to deal with this. And the gymnastics, when you start seeing people doing gymnastics to save their faith, and you see Christians doing this all the time, you see more Muslims doing this all the time, when you see that sort of thing, you got to sit back and go, oh dear. Because if that's the best defense I can come up with, then my faith is in big trouble. It should be. I mean, if this is the best you can do, then that's not going to work. So I point out that Mormonism is a moving target, and some Mormons may possibly appeal to the Book of Mormon to affirm the unity and infinity of God. Here's a reference in the Book of Mormon. This is Alma 11. Now, Zizram said, "Is there more than one God?" And Amulek answered, "No." However, Tucker explains that according to Mormonism, Joseph Smith's teaching supersedes or explains further the intent of these texts. As we have seen, he presents God as a finite being. Brigham Young himself said that God has once been a finite being. Tucker later explains this: "The whole of Mormon doctrine and ritual is hinged on the concept of the plurality of gods. Indeed, this doctrine of the plurality of gods is so comprehensive and glorious," writes Mormon theologian Bruce McConkie, "that it reaches out and embraces every exalted personage. Those who attain exaltation are gods. For a Mormon, salvation is exaltation." And what's being said here is that you, if you're a good Mormon, you too will become a god. You will take your wives to a planet and populate it. And this is why there's a split between the fundamentalist Mormons and the LDS. The Latter-day Saints decided to obey the government when it concluded that polygamy was illegal. And this happened in the late 19th century, and there were some court cases that established this as precedent. And the courts ruled that marriage is between one man and one woman. Pause. Moving forward. So you have polygamy being outlawed, and what happened is the fundamentalists said no, and that's why you have pockets in Utah and other places of fundamentalist Mormons saying, we're living out the principle. The principle is many wives. Why? I got to take these women with me to heaven or to the afterlife and populate a planet and be a god over that planet. How am I going to do that if I don't have my wives with me?
For further question for you, what further characteristics are there of the cosmic deities? Because if they're saying that you can attain this exaltation, in other words, become a god, what is their evidence for that? Has there been a Mormon who's attained this?
Yeah, Joseph Smith. In fact,
he's the only one, so what about everybody else?
No. Brigham Young, all the great saints of the Mormon canon have gone on to deity.
But do they go through deity through death, or does it?
Yeah, they die. No. They die,
and then happen while you're living.
That is correct. You have to go through the shadow of death, the valley of the shadow of death, before you attain godhood. Okay. There's no empirical verification. In other words, what you're asking for is not going to be had. Now the exaltation of the Mormon comes through the gate of celestial marriage, and according to McConkie, it is eternal life, the kind of life which God lives. So marriage is salvation. And so by telling Mormons that they can't marry many women, they are actually blocking their road to salvation. So who's right in this debate between the LDS and the fundamentalists? I think the fundamentalists are right. I mean, Joseph Smith had many wives. As Mormon apologist Stephen Robinson explains, we Mormons believe that God and humans are the same species of being and that all men and women were his spiritual offspring in a premortal existence. So even if you were to massage these texts to try to come up with, say, one God, the point is that as long as you're a Mormon, you must believe that God and humans are only different in degree. God is not different in kind to his creatures. He's only different in degree.
What's the difference between that, which we would call polytheism, would we not? And
yeah, I would call it polytheism, but, you know, henotheism is a kind of polytheism.
Henotheism, okay. What would be the difference in that, and I know we haven't gotten to it yet, but panentheism? Because doesn't it say that basically God and humans are on the same level?
This is a really great point. Panentheists want to say that God is the soul of the universe. And so there's a hair's breadth between a panentheist and a pantheist. But what's really interesting is that your Mormon intellectuals now are trying to yoke Mormonism with panentheism. So there are a good number of their philosophers that are going in the direction of panentheism, because you have to. How do you explain, like you said, the appearance of the gods? There has to be a spiritual something that's generating all of this. And a kind of personalized pantheism, which you get in panentheism, may be the metaphysical framework to understand all of this.
Okay.
One could even argue that there's an implicit henotheism in most polytheistic modes of thought. For perhaps the best way to avoid chaos is to maintain a cosmos, but the only way to bring about true order is if there is someone supreme. Hence, Hindus have their Indra or Brahma, the Greeks and Romans have their Zeus or Jupiter. It should not come as a surprise to see Mormons embracing Father Elohim as the supreme ruler over all the gods. Now, there is another version of polytheism called bitheism, also known as ditheism. The label bitheism just means two gods. And what you do here is you believe that there's a god that is good and then there's a god that is evil. So you explain the war between good and evil, or cosmos and chaos, by postulating two entities. And Zoroastrianism is the best version of bitheism that I'm aware of.
Never even heard of that.
Zoroastrianism was born in the 6th century BC. There you go, another thing that happened. It's a Persian religion, and then it evolved over time. On page 55... I point out that the god of Zoroaster, who's the founder of Zoroastrianism, have you heard of the book by Nietzsche, Thus Spoke Zarathustra? Mm-hmm. Well, Zarathustra is another name for Zoroaster. The god of Zoroaster is called Ahura Mazda, right? By the way, you'll notice that most of the cars we drive around in, the names we give to them are either after some animal or some pagan god. So... Mazda, you know. The all-knowing creator of the cosmos, supreme above all else, and the only being worthy of worship. According to Zoroaster, there's an evil spirit called Angra Manu who opposes Ahura Mazda. But Zoroaster's own teachings are not dualistic, since the evil spirit is not equal to Ahura Mazda in any respect. Many people have tried to... say that there's an influence of Zoroastrianism on Christian theology. Zoroastrianism did come earlier than Christianity, and like Zoroastrianism, Christianity posits a cosmic war going on in the spiritual realm between the all-powerful God and a significantly less powerful Satan. But that is overly simplistic. In the first place, we were not sure when Zoroaster lived, although most place them between 628 and 550 BC. And one can already see a full-blown monotheism in both the pre-exilic and early post-exilic prophets. By the way, it is often thought that the Bible was originally polytheistic, and that in itself it evolved into embracing a monotheistic viewpoint.
How would it have been considered polytheistic?
biblical critics try to find traces of polytheism by noting, like, there are times where Baal is given credence in the Psalms, or at least the imagery from Canaanite folk religion is taken over in the Psalms. And so the idea is that the Hebrews believed in many gods as well, but they worship Yahweh as their God.
Okay.
Is
he not ascribed to be a pagan god?
There are biblical critics who will say that, you know, Yahweh was just the god of war that got elevated over time as a as the supreme deity. But the Hebrews were no less cultic than their neighbors, and their creation stories and all that were just as pagan and so forth, so-called, quote-unquote, as their neighbors, and that it was just over time that they began to be purely monotheistic. Most agree that by the time we reach the 6th century B.C., the Hebrews were fully monotheistic. But before that, they were at least henotheistic, if not polytheistic altogether.
Does that take away from the validity of...
Yeah, if you believe that, you would have to say that the whatever inspiration means, it can't mean that God breathed in the words of his truth to the prophets and they breathed them out on the text. You would have to say something like, God gave very vague concepts to his prophets and they ran with them. And it was just it took a long time for them to overcome the polytheism of their neighbors.
So how do we account for it then? How do we account for references to... You said it's Baal or Baal?
Baal.
Okay, Baal.
Some people say Baal, but it's actually Baal.
Okay. How do we account for his presence?
How do we account for whose presence?
Baal's.
Okay. It's clear that the prophets are utilizing... that imagery to make it clear that Yahweh is more sovereign than Baal. By taking on an attribute of Baal, Yahweh is proving himself to be more powerful.
But that still doesn't say that Baal doesn't exist. Right?
So you have
Yahweh and Baal.
Yeah, right. One of the arguments for polytheism in Israel is that we've actually found idols all throughout Israel that were flourishing during this time. I mean, they were very prevalent during the days of the king. So even during the days of King David, there were many Israelites that engaged in polytheism. Now, what's interesting is that that's the very thing that the Bible says. The Bible says these people in Israel who were Israelites, children of the covenant, always ran after these other gods. And that was a constant thorn in the side of the prophets. So they are constantly recognizing this and mad about it. So the archaeological discoveries have vindicated the very complaints that the prophets are given. So why that proves anything against what they're saying, I'm not sure, because they themselves are complaining about it.
Well, you could bring into question to the commandment, you shall have no other gods before me.
That's actually considered to have traces of polytheism in it, because you shall have no other gods before me recognizes the existence of other gods.
Or at least the images what? And idols.
When we get to the critique of polytheism, maybe I can clear some things up for you, but I would simply say that you have two choices. You either say there was an evolution going on here in which, say, Abraham was a henotheist or at least a polytheist. An evolution of thought.
Okay.
That goes from, say, a henotheism, polytheism in Abraham to a full-blown monotheism that existed in the 6th century B.C., or you say that monotheism was just there all along. However, it was that the prophets often took that imagery to make a point. Maybe in the same way a preacher might quote from a Buddhist scripture just to make a point, but that doesn't mean that he thinks that Buddhism is true or that he's worshiping Buddha or anything like that.
Just like today, we don't deny that the belief in the existence of other gods... This is what we're doing right now. We're talking about all these other beliefs,
sure.
And beliefs in all these other gods, and yet many of us would still have the perspective that of monotheism, but that doesn't deny that these other beliefs
sure.
exist out there.
Sure,
so
exactly.
It could be that the Bible is saying the same thing.
That's exactly right. By the way, recognizing the existence of a being is not the same thing as saying that that being is equal to Yahweh. That's also another thing to keep in mind. And I'll develop that point in just a minute. So that's the first problem with saying that Zoroastrianism influenced Christianity. A second thing to point out is that it took a long time for Zoroastrianism to capture the hearts of the Persians. For example, the Persian king Cyrus the Great, who allowed the Jews to go back to their homeland in 538 BC, was not a Zoroastrian. And even those kings we know to be Zoroastrian continue to worship other gods besides Ahura Mazda. Thus, if we maintain that the Jews borrowed from Zoroastrians, we would have to conclude that they embraced many of Zoroaster's ideas before the Persians themselves, which would be strange. Third, the resemblances between Zoroastrianism and historic Judeo-Christianity are superficial at best. For first of all, we know very little about the Zoroastrianism of the Achaemenid dynasty, which flourished between 558 and 330 BC. Much of what we do know, second of all, comes from writings considerably later than the biblical writings. And thirdly, what we do know reflects the garbled, magic-obsessed, syncretistic religion of the Magi, hardly the Zoroastrianism necessary for the Jews to use as a source for the biblical version. Fourthly, there is no reason to think that the Jews themselves were not the ones who influenced the Zoroastrians. James Moulton writes this. He says, it is perhaps as well to remember that these theories do not come from Iranian experts, but from scholars whose fame was achieved in other fields. Were we to count only the Iranists, we should even doubt whether the Parsi did not borrow from the Jew, for that was the view of the Iranian scholar Dharmastater. The name Ahura Mazda was later changed to Armazad, while the name Angramanu was later changed to Ahriman. Throughout its history, Zoroastrianism resisted the temptation to place these two gods on a par, but with the rise of Zoroastrianism and then Manichaeanism, these two gods became equals. Zervon, which originally meant time, was the name given to the god who fathered Ormazad and Ahriman. This resembles Greek polytheism, where Kronos, time, was the father of Zeus, or at least the father of chaos that created Zeus. Eventually, Zervon came to refer to the whole space-time universe. In other words, Zervonism is another form of pantheism. Manichaeanism, which began about the same time as Zervonism, gets its name from Mani, who lived in the 3rd century AD. Manichaeanism teaches that there is a war going on in the cosmos between light or spirit and darkness or matter. Thus, that which is spirit is good, that which is matter is evil, and each of us has a spirit that is trapped in the evil body. Our goal in life is to be released from the body and reunite with God, the source of light. Note again that Manichaeanism, which teaches us that we will all be absorbed into God at the end of our lives, is yet another form of pantheism. Augustine was a Manichaean before he became a Christian. In fact, St. Augustine have you read the Confessions? It's the book you need to read as a young Christian. It's just fantastic. And St. Augustine, this is a really funny story. He started seeing intellectual problems with Manichaeanism. And so, I forget the guy's name. I'm embarrassed. But there was a great scholar of Manichaeanism that was coming into town. And everybody was saying to him, look, when this guy comes, he's going to answer all your questions. You know, he was like the Josh McDowell, you know, of his day for Manichaeanism. You know, he's going to answer all the questions and give you all the answers you need. You just wait and see. And so finally, the great apologist for Manichaeanism came into town, and Augustine goes up to him and starts grilling him with questions. And he is just depressed over how lame this guy's answers are. And so he has a crisis of faith. He begins to say, well, this stuff is just BS. It just isn't true. And he eventually sees Christianity as a far more plausible worldview. So he had to go through that whole mental exercise to finally get to Christianity. Finally, there's finite godism. This version of polytheism insists that only one God exists, but also insists that the God is finite in knowledge and power. William James offered this view of God as a helpful alternative to theism and pantheism. And Peter Bertocci tells us that God is all good but not all powerful. Why so? Why can't God be limited in goodness as well as power? Why can't he become evil? To this, Bertocci writes, he might be, but he will not. For a person can destroy what his intelligence knows to be good, but he will be all the less likely to do this if he knows the consequences of such evil. We place finite godism within the polytheistic worldview because when all is said and done, the God of finite godism is king in name only. He may have created the world, but he can't control it. The elements of our universe now compete with him for supremacy. Whether God wins out in the end is anybody's guess. So here's some common elements among polytheists. And from now on, we'll be doing these bullet points at the end as a summary.
Okay.
Common elements. The gods are created. There once was a time when the gods were not. To be sure, polytheists may disagree over who brought the gods into being. The Greeks insisted that time brought Zeus into existence, while the Hindus say Brahman brought Brahma into existence, while Joseph Smith insists that there was never a beginning of the process. Finite goddesses are the exception here, for some say that God created the world out of pre-existing matter, while others say he brought the world into existence out of nothing. That said, finite goddesses are agreed that God has always been God. The gods are finite in knowledge, power, and goodness. Jeremiah gave me a link to the Norse mythology. Grela Inni, I think is the name of it. This is the story of Thor and Asgard and all of that, and I'm reading it now. And it's funny because they actually have a cosmic quiz bowl in the Great Hall, and Thor is having a really hard time living up to all of the challenges that Loki's giving him. Like Thor says, I can outdrink anybody, and he can't outdrink. He can't drink out of the big horn that is given to him to drink from, and so he actually gets sick. And then he goes, well, I can wrestle anybody. And so Loki sends an old woman to wrestle Thor, and through his magic, Thor is having a hard time to wrestle this woman. And so he's clearly finite in knowledge and power. And at one point, the gods get kind of upset over the fact that they can't answer all the major big questions in life, and so they sort of go away.
This is in the text.
So it's interesting how, in other words, I'm not imposing this on them. This is what they themselves are saying about their gods. They're finite.
What
and
the gods are saying about themselves.
Yeah, the gods are saying this about themselves. This is what the people are saying about them. The gods learn from other facts from other gods. They cannot control everything that happens. And they manifest a cruelty, they manifest a mixture of emotions and dispositions, everything from uncontrolled anger to wanton cruelty to benevolence to lust and so forth. As we have seen, the gods are limited by time. In fact, they once did not exist. The gods exist within the universe and are thus limited by space. The gods have bodies. They do not see all that is going on in the universe. And many even need rest and food in order to function in a healthy way. Many of the gods don't even care for humans, which is to be expected, since many of them are unaware of what's going on at any given time. Their limited knowledge and presence demand that they only care for certain persons at certain times. And their fickle emotions will inevitably lead them to hate quite a few persons and love others in accordance with their changing dispositions. All right, so any questions about that before we get into evaluation? All right, evaluation, contributions. First, polytheists helpfully recognize the need for a personal deity. The impersonal all is not a being the common person on the street can relate to. So polytheists rightly recognize the need to anchor religious expression in something personal. Second, polytheists rightly recognize a need to explain much of the order we see in the world. What is it that brings cosmos out of chaos? The gods, with their tremendous power, are able to control the forces of nature. Third, polytheists rightly recognize the need for humans to have an explanation for why our world can be chaotic at times. Why is there often chaos in our lives? Because the gods are not all-powerful. They often strive against each other. So we should not be surprised when we witness fortuitously chaotic events in nature. Fourth, polytheism, especially of those who are animists, is built upon one of the most perplexing questions philosophers and scientists still struggle with. How does inanimate matter produce life? The animistic answer is mistaken, we believe, but the question itself is an important one that simply cannot be dismissed with a shrug. And finally, polytheism is a helpful metaphor illustrating the diversity of our existence. A worldview that reduces all things to a rigid unity surely contradicts experience, which manifests change and discontinuity. Polytheists rightly avoid this pitfall by believing in an ultimate that is fundamentally diverse. Can you think of any other good things about polytheism? I'll give you one more Marvel Cinematic Universe. I do love me some Thor. It's awesome.
So you could say creativity?
Creativity, yes. It's very creative.
Now, I particularly like this idea of your final statement here in this paragraph. A worldview that reduces all things to a rigid unity surely contradicts experience, which manifests change and discontinuity. So, from a positive perspective, you know, polytheists or polytheism can reconcile that.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, that's a positive.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, I have to conclude that polytheism is false. it's an insufficient worldview. Now, here's my point. I'm not saying that it's false because the gods have never been empirically verified, although that is a problem because they, in principle, can be empirically verified. At least in the Christian tradition, for example, God is conceived to be invisible, and so you're not able... I mean, there's no way a Christian could answer the empirical challenge that someone gives, well, show me your God, or point God out to me. Well, in principle, the Christian can't do that because God himself says, I'm invisible.
So why can a polytheist?
But a polytheist, in principle, has gods that are empirically verifiable. They have bodies that can be seen, that have manifested themselves to people in the past. So where are they? But my point is not that. That's a problem, but I'm not going to say that polytheism is false or something like that because we can't empirically verify the gods. I mean, a polytheist could just look at me and smile and say, well, they just took a trip, and I guess I'll be back later. You know, he doesn't have to answer that question, and his inability to answer that question doesn't mean that his worldview is false. But it is a problem. It's just not a devastating one. But here are a few reasons I think it's an insufficient worldview. Notice it's not self-defeating. You're not defeating yourself if you say Zeus exists. It's not like agnosticism, which says, I know that you can't know. It's if you say Zeus exists, you've not made a self-defeating proclamation. First, polytheism offers itself as a religious perspective that gives the average person an explanation for why things happen. However, religion is intimately tied to worship, and worship is the act whereby one attributes ultimate worth to a certain object of devotion. So how can the polytheist attribute ultimate worth to a being or group of beings he admits is finite and not ultimate? We cannot help but see his decision to worship any of the finite gods of polytheism as inconsistent. In other words, you're admitting that your God is not ultimate, so why are you giving ultimate worth to it? Paul Tillich, the great theologian, said that religion is all about one's ultimate concern. You're ultimately concerned about what you grant is not ultimate. If the gods respond by cosmic forces, then why not worship those things rather than the gods who were made by them? And why Zeus over Aphrodite or Brahma over Vishnu? The devotee of one deity has no more reason to worship one god rather than the other. So your choice of worship is arbitrary.
Doesn't really matter. You can pick it between any of them.
Yeah. Zeus, Aphrodite, who cares? Second.
Well,
go ahead.
With that, wouldn't they say that the different gods have different functions, and therefore what suits me best, I should worship? So.
But that is, by definition, arbitrary. Mm-hmm. I mean, what suits me?
Yeah.
I just feel like going for Aphrodite because I want to be a really good lover. You know? So that's, I mean, but there's nothing out there that says that love is more virtuous than war, right? So I don't know, you know, why one worships one person is just at their whim, at their purely subjective feeling. Second, and following the first point, the various deities are admittedly fickle, resembling humans in almost every way. The polytheist must wrestle with why he chooses to worship deities whose unethical behavior rivals that of any human tyrant. What really is the difference between worshiping an adulterous Zeus and an adulterous politician? No real difference can be offered, rendering polytheism an arbitrary perspective. The answer that one might give is that Zeus is more powerful than the politician. This only creates yet another problem for the polytheist. Namely, polytheism, this is the third point, leads to a might-makes-right ethics, or view of ethics. Indeed, the reason we are to attribute worth to the gods is that they'll punish us if we do not worship and or pay homage to them. But most of us intuitively recognize that might does not always make right. The strong are often evil. Therefore, the gods of polytheism are not worthy of worship. Fourth, there is at least one important metaphysical problem with polytheism, and this fully embraces the idea that it's not a sufficient view of reality. This is true even if we granted the existence of these super deities. So notice what I'm doing. I'm saying, let's assume that your gods exist. There's still a big problem. Even if they do exist, the polytheists have told us that they have been created by the cosmos or some feature of the cosmos. But these gods were spawned by natural forces. They were and continue to be nothing more than isolated facts which make up the furniture of the universe. Therefore, they are just one more set of facts that must be interpreted within the context of a worldview.
Can we unpack that statement a little bit?
I think I'm going to.
Okay.
So if I don't do it to your satisfaction, we'll go back.
Okay.
So to repeat my point, excuse me. These gods were spawned by natural forces, and because of that, they are nothing more than isolated facts which make up the furniture of the universe. Therefore, they are just one more set of facts that must be interpreted within the context of a worldview. To put the point another way, the gods of polytheism exist within the universe and hence exist within a universe that is either caused by God, not caused by God, identical to God, or codependent with God. In other words, you can't make sense out of these gods without embracing another worldview like theism or atheism or pantheism or panentheism. That's the only way to really interpret their significance.
Because you have to say that they're... But
the universe created Zeus.
But who created the universe?
And so where does the universe come from? Well, you could say, well, there's no God of any kind beyond the universe that created the universe, and therefore atheism is true. So Zeus is a product of an atheistic universe. Now, you might say to me, that's weird. You can't say that the gods exist if you're an atheist. Oh, yes, you can. I'll give you two examples. The Roman atheist Lucretius in the first century BC, he was an atheist, but he did not deny the existence of the gods. He just said the gods are all material. They are not spirit. He denied the existence of spirit, and that's kind of the hallmark of atheism. Most atheists are materialists. Everything that exists is just physical. And the gods exist, and they are physical too, and that's what made him an atheist. The modern myth of Star Trek is a modern atheistic myth. And Captain Kirk and his crew actually flew to a planet, and guess who they ran into? Apollo. In The Next Generation, Captain Jean-Luc Picard often has to face up to a guy named Q, who has godlike powers. In other words, in the Star Trek universe, the gods are just aliens on other planets who are just further along in evolution than we are. And they run into these kinds of beings all the time. So an atheist can make sense out of the gods of the Greek pantheon. They are just super evolved creatures. Now you say, well, can a theist do that? Yeah. A theist can recognize the existence of other gods. They are metaphysically inferior to the one true God, but they are super creatures. Actually, most theists do believe in these beings, and they call them angels. And of course, you can be a pantheist and be a polytheist. You see that in Hinduism all the time. And even though I don't know many panentheists who also embrace polytheism, I don't see why you couldn't. Mormonism is actually trying to yoke itself to panentheism right now. A lot of your philosophers in Mormonism are doing that right now. So all, and the very fact that Mormonism is doing that indicates that they recognize that they do not embrace a sufficient view of the world. And therefore, they're having to anchor their gods in something more ultimate than the gods themselves.
What about the statement that you said earlier when speaking about Mormonism, that the universe is eternal? So if it is eternal, there are ultimate, unlimited possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So does that not explain this, the existence of the universe being caused by God? Well, it was just eternal, so it was always there.
But what you're criticizing is maybe the Mormon attempt to anchor their polytheism in panentheism. Maybe what I hear you saying is that maybe atheism should be the default position. In other words, the atheist says that the universe is eternal, and given eternity, anything that can happen will happen. And so maybe these super creatures evolved and spawned other worlds and that sort of thing and manipulated things. And in the Star Trek universe, in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, humans developed the ability to create a planet with life in 6 minutes. I don't know if you saw that movie, but you know, Spock and McCoy get in a big debate over it. And McCoy says, you know, according to myth, the world was created in 6 days. Watch out, here comes Genesis, we'll do it in 6 minutes. And this shows how our technology has taken us to a point where we are godlike to other creatures. In fact, in the Star Trek universe, there are times when the Starship Enterprise goes to a planet and there's an inferior species in terms of technology. They find intelligent life that is not as advanced as they are. And the first thing they have to do is say to these people, hey, we're not gods. You know, we're just creatures like you. So,
So you're saying still, though, that the universe and its causality has to be explained by some form of a worldview. So you're saying
my claim is not that the universe must be explained. Yeah, that's not my claim. My claim is very simple. Polytheism is insufficient because they say that their own gods were products of this universe. And so we have a context to understand these gods, namely a universe. Now, the question does present itself, what about the universe? What is the nature of this universe? Now, you could say that the universe needs a cause, in which case you're a theist, and that means that the polytheists would have to understand their gods in the context of theism. So theism would be the overarching worldview to understand these gods. However, you might look at me and say, no, the universe does not need a cause. Well, now you have three options. You have a halfway option between saying the universe is caused or uncaused, namely panentheism, where God is sort of working with the universe to mold it into something, and Mormons are going in that direction. Or you could say that the universe is pure mind, spirit. That means it's pantheistic. And that's what explains the eruption of these gods. Or you could just be a plain old atheist and say the universe is wholly unexplained, wholly uncaused, eternal, and so forth, and the gods are spawned by that universe.
Okay.
Now, obviously, I'm not settling the debate between these four other worldviews. I'm simply saying that polytheism is insufficient as a worldview for that very reason.
It's dependent upon another to give it ultimate explanation.
Right, it's dependent upon another to explain its shortcomings. All right?
Okay.
Now, the polytheist finds himself, therefore, borrowing from one or all of the other world viewpoints to make up for the inadequacies inherent in his own. But this is exactly what we mean by insufficient. Since the worldview of polytheism cannot provide us with an ultimate that is self-contained, as even they admit, it fails as a worldview. Like agnosticism, it is merely a perspective one can adopt within the context of other worldviews available to humans. Hence, it is not the case that there are five worldviews, there are only four. To the finite goddess who insists that God created the universe out of pre-existing matter, we insist that his view suffers the same fate as the other polytheisms we have surveyed. For if matter is as eternal as the finite God, then matter is equal to that God, and both find themselves warring in a universe that is either theistic, atheistic, pantheistic, or panentheistic. To the finite goddess who insists that God created the universe out of nothing, we respond that it takes infinite power to bridge the gap between nothing and something. Hence, the finite God is actually the God of theism in disguise. So I think it's inconsistent to say that your God is finite and he bridged the qualitatively infinite gap between nothing and something, which is what the God of theism supposedly did. Well, you can't be a finite goddess and hold to creation out of nothing. I think that's inconsistent. Finally, to the finite goddess who insists that God is all-powerful, but he's not all-powerful, but he is all-good, I just say that's arbitrary. When Bertacci says that God will not do evil since he knows the consequences of an evil act, we need to point out that humans often know the consequences of evil acts we do, and yet many of us do them anyway. A God who is finite in power must find himself from time to time suffering from similar temptations as ourselves, and so this God has given us no reason to think otherwise. In other words, the finite goddess has given us no reason to think otherwise. Therefore, there can be little doubt that finite goddism, like all other versions of polytheism, cannot be true. And so our list looks a little bit different now. We've scratched out polytheism as well as agnosticism. And so then there were four. That's all I have to say to you today, unless you have a question or two. All right, well then we will meet again tomorrow.